Zizek finished his studies in 71, 72, and he already his graduation thesis, which was on Heidegger, which is called Bolichina Razlika, the pain of the difference. There is a woman who's called Caitlin Tucker-Sorensen.
Yeah, we're interviewing her at some point.
Yeah, you should. You should. She studied in Ljubljana. She learned Slovene. She's very knowledgeable about the. She was particularly interested in him. She made her PhD on the early developments of the Ljubljana school. So she stopped in 89, in the moment when both Zizek became famous with the sublime object of ideology, and at the same time Yugoslavia fell apart. You know, so this was a sort of watershed, and she stops there. She studies just 20 years prior to this. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And she published a paper on the Slavoj's first book, the Pain of Difference, so the Heideggerian settling accounts with Heidegger, let's say. But then he was employed as an intern at the Department of Philosophy, and there was an explicit promise that he would get the position of an assistant professor the moment he would finish his MA. And so he submitted his MA, which was a thick affair. I think it was a brilliant text. I mean, what I talked before, that I think he was one of the first people who could figure out what exactly is this structuralist current. I mean, worldwide. I think the only comparable sort of narrative is Frederick Jameson's The Prison House of Language, which appeared at that time, but at that time we didn't know it. So which was the first sort of attempt to make a narrative of what structuralism is and why is it important. And so he submitted this, and the MA thesis was rejected, not on the ground of any shortcomings of treating the matter. Nobody could say anything about this because he knew far more than professors did about this. but it got rejected because of inappropriate relation to Marxism. It doesn't come across as Marxist enough. He sort of kind of endorses, I mean, although there are many, many critical passages, both critical of all these figures and also critical of Frank School. But nevertheless, he didn't come across as Marxist enough, and so he was forced to write an appendix. This appendix is really interesting. I mean, I've recently written on this. I can send you the text if you are.
Please,
that'd be great.
Because I don't know if you know Dominique Finkelde.
Yeah.
You should interview him as well, because he's now he is organizing this Zizek handbook, which is a major project. I mean, I think he's got some 40 people sort of writing.
Oh, wow.
Great. This will be a really a milestone. I don't know. This will be a very important thing in Zizek studies.
And so he
asked me to write something on Zizek's MA, and I wrote a piece. The appendix he wrote, it was a sort of he explained his relation to Marxism and how this fits together, but not in the way that would be to their liking. And I'll come back to this, but just as a result of this, he never got a job. No, he never got a job which was promised to him. And at the time, he was just married, he had a small child, and he actually was unemployed, which is really absurd, because this was a socialist country where unemployment was really not a problem at that time, you know. There was this sort of social thinking that everybody is entitled to have a job. I mean, unemployment was minuscule. And for Zizek to be unemployed of all people, it's kind of absurd. And so he had to actually survive on translating, I mean, publishing some things and translating for a couple of years. While at the Department of Philosophy, three new positions were open and three new people were taken on who didn't have, any of them didn't have the comparable sort of references, because Slavoj has published quite a bit. I mean, he's a compulsive writer, okay, it's no problem, but he's published quite a bit. By that time, if you look at the bibliography, it was just incomparable, beyond. So the appendix, should I talk about that? What he did in the appendix is he took a quote from Engels, from Engels's The Origin of State, Family, and Private Property, whatever is the English title of the book, where Engels says basically that the basis of everything is material production, but material production is twofold. One is the production of things, and the other one is production of people, which means, he actually uses a phrase similar to that, which means that you have to have a production for people to enter into culture, to become subjects, to be educated, to be able then to enter the production, this other production. No? So people have to be produced. I mean, this is why family, this is great interest in the family and the family structures and the structures of kinship and the primitive societies and whatever. No? So in this quote, and this is really very strange, Engels takes those two things as being comparable. No? There's production of things and there is production of people, the production, the cultural production. No? And Slavoj basically said, look, those two things, both are material, no? And they condition each other. And I mean, you don't have just production of things without people being produced as cultural subjects. No? And this is what structuralism is about, you know? Look at Levi-Strauss, look at the structures of kinship, or all these primitive societies, so-called primitive societies, no? This is precisely a materialist theory of production of people, of signifying practice. So you have the production, material production on one hand, and you have the signifying practice on the other hand. And structuralism is a serious materialist theory of signifying practice as this other part of production, which Engels himself says is the basis of everything. No? So the basis, material basis, is not just simply the material production, but also the cultural production. This belongs to the basis, not to the superstructure. No? And from there, he tried to then develop how this different, how psychoanalysis deals with this. And this is precisely the materialist theory of production of subjectivity. How do we become subjects? What is the conflictual process that one has to undergo to enter culture? And what is the price to be paid for this? Why do we have an unconscious, et cetera, et cetera? So, he somehow put all these other things under the general heading of signifying practice. Now, material practice versus signifying practice. The signifying practice is not less material or less important than the other one. Now, and he again found another quote in Marx in Capital 3. You have the quote which is actually more frequently quoted, where Marx says that the real realm of freedom starts only beyond the material production. No. So that the material production is not simply, this is not the doctrine, the dogma, everything, the basis of everything is material production. But you can see the production is twofold, and you must see that Marx himself envisaged freedom as something being beyond material production. No? Mm. So this was the basic argument, but I'm simplifying a great deal. I can send you the paper.
So in that kind of context, how is it that Lacan and Hegel rise to prominence for you guys?
Well, it all started in this in a world which is kind of unimaginable now. I mean, the world of the aftermath of May 68. And May 68, we were a generation of May 68. I mean, May 68 can be fetishized or culturalized as a cultural icon or whatever, but it was a real event, or at least a name for that condenses so many processes that went on at that time. And there was the subculture, the counterculture, there was Woodstock at the same time, you know?
Right.
There were figures like Che Guevara, Martin Luther King. There was Rudi Dutschke, you know, the Rudi Dutschke who was shot at in Germany. There were student revolts, there were anti-Vietnam War revolts. Mm-hmm. There was the sexual revolution. There was the beginning of a serious feminist movement, the gay movement. It all stems from there, you know. Everything, all that happened in a very short time. And the intellectual superstructure, as it were precisely those things I started to speak about, which is Frankfurt School and structuralism. Structuralism in France and Frankfurt School, okay, Marcuse was at the time in America. He was the figure of the student revolts very much. He was seen as sort of a theoretician of the student revolts. So it's a time which is kind of unimaginable because it was a time of great opening. At the time, and there was also the anti-colonial struggles because and during the 60s, like each year, few African countries became independent. You know, there was this solidarity with the anti-colonial struggle. So it was a sort of global thing. And it was a time of a great opening, which is so hard to imagine today because now it seems we live in a time of great closure. Mm-hmm. You know? Like from Che Guevara to Trump, you know, it's the story of my life. You know, how could we live through a certain time which raised so much hope and sort of expectation that radical change was around the corner? That is a serious possibility of change and revolution, as it were. There are differences that make a difference. Each of those differences made a difference, and the expectations were running high. You know, so there's a whole story now, what happened in the 50 years, you know, for all this to be somehow stifled and to come up against the problems we have today, which are of a completely different kind. But I started speaking about this to just somehow mention this era of enthusiasm that was in the air at the time, and the student revolts in Ljubljana were part of this. And structuralism was part of this general enthusiasm. And we embraced this as the revolutionary thought, which is somehow parallel to what, May 68 as a sort of one slogan that condenses so many things. And we started studying this very seriously in the 70s in Ljubljana. And by the end of the 70s, worked our way to the conclusion that Lacan is the one who leads the furthest in this structural revolution. But where did everyone else? I mean, we started, in a textbook manner with Levi-Strauss and Saussure and Jacobson and Benveniste and then Althusser, Foucault, and then came Derrida and Deleuze. When we started all this, there was a group of people in Ljubljana who somehow were stuck with this enthusiasm, I mean, and imbued with this enthusiasm and then came, I mean, through work, came to the conclusion that Lacan is the one who goes the furthest. If one had to single out one particular thing, is his theory of the subject, you know? Because structuralism at the time was seen as a current which has done away with the subject. You know? La mort de l'homme, the death of man, you know, a misleading slogan of Foucault, you know, and everybody thought this is the end of humanism, this is the end of subject, only the structures, only the structures, whatever. So where should we cover? Where is the world coming to? And Lacan actually had a theory of the subject which was non-trivial, which was not a humanist theory of the subject, but which was a very important kind of new notion of the subject, which can then be linked to the Hegelian legacy, And what we learned from the Frankfurt School was not so much the humanist alienation, desalienation theory, but actually that you can't do without Hegel. You can't. Hegel is nevertheless the philosophical background on which with which you have to come to grips. You have to work this through, and then we thought kind of that this was a big shortcoming of the structuralist revolution in France, that they saw Hegel mostly as the enemy, the sort of black enemy against which they defined themselves as structuralist. And you can see this in almost every one of them. You know, in Deleuze, you have this famous phrase, oublier Hegel, forget Hegel. You know, not overcome Hegel, not criticize Hegel, forget this ever happened. This is the best way to be rid of this. No? And of course, Lacan was in a strange way very closely connected to Hegel. I mean, having listened to Kojève's lectures in the 30s, and Kojève was his big other in matters of philosophy. And of course, there was this Hegelian thread, but which again was, yes, is something we could relate to, but at the same time it was problematic because the Kojève reading is problematic. Our reading was quite a different kind of Hegel. But nevertheless, Hegel and Lacan, in the end, after a lot of reflection, a lot of evenings spent in hours of discussion and quite some bottles, empty bottles, there was a decision, yes. There was the upshot that somehow we can't do without those two guys, you know, and trying to figure out how they hang together.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't hang together quite in the way that Lacan imagined, because we were at all times critical of the Kojèvian take. Because Lacan basically never read Hegel, I mean, he read Kojève. That was the trouble. This was the trouble which we immediately saw, because we did read Hegel. No, we saw how biased his view was through the Kojèvian lens. He could only see what Kojève could see. No.
So Lacan, in a way, was your gateway to Hegel?
Lacan was, I mean, Hegel was there quite independently as something which we thought was the most important part of the Frankfurt School legacy.
Okay.
The one thing we learned from the Frankfurt School is that you have to seriously engage with Hegel. There is no way of saying, this is a metaphysician which we want to step out of metaphysics. Let's leave this behind. No way.
It's funny hearing you speak about this, because for people like us coming decades after and reading all of your work, the connection between Lacan and Hegel seems kind of manifest. But the idea that at some point it was argued and decided upon is interesting to hear.
Yes. Yes. No, it was not manifest to, to many people. I don't think so. No, because also the French Lacanians, no, they would stay clear of Hegel. No, they wouldn't insist on this Kojèvian legacy of Lacan. They're somewhat embarrassed by it even. No? And you will not find French Lacanian Hegelians, hardly.
Mm.
I think the whole atmosphere in France was pretty much anti-Hegelian in the aftermath of 68.
So would you say that this approach to Lacan and Hegel could kind of only have happened in the context of Ljubljana and Yugoslavia?
It had to happen somewhere outside of the metropoles, of the big centers. Because one trouble with the French culture and one trouble with the German culture is that they are self-referential to a very large extent. They don't, they relate to themselves and to their own traditions and continue those traditions This is from the, if you look at the things from the German side, I mean, they thought that structuralism was a catastrophe of thought. They didn't engage with it seriously. Well into the 80s, after we did our things, then they started considering that there's something there. Because they were so deeply ingrained in the superiority of German thought as being the true profound philosophical reflection and speculation, as opposed to the French who are superficial. There's a profound prejudice on both sides. Mm-hmm. You know? The French didn't read the Germans. The Germans didn't read the French at a time where both things were extremely important. We have an eccentric position, the position outside of the big centers of thought. And we could read both French and German at a time when those things were coming out, you know. Hmm. And it's a kind of privilege to belong to a small country, a small culture, to have to, one can perhaps, it's more easy to see how to, what's going on and how these things could possibly fit together. No? It was only much later that the one side and the other sort of started to see that there are many common battles. And there is one of the, I mean, very symptomatic, is one of the last interviews of Foucault in 1984, I think, where he says, why didn't anybody tell me about Frankfurt School? I mean, it would have spared me so much trouble. You know? Because it's so much of it was already done. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, even Foucault, who spoke German, never followed the developments of Frankfurt School during the time of his big books. And read that only afterwards. Okay, but this is sort of a bit of a cultural history.
Oh, it's very interesting, I'm sure, for all of our listeners and for us as well. There's an emphasis in that book on the decline of symbolic efficiency. And you've said, as regards paternal authority, that it was like the dead father himself who died. So could you speak on the decline of symbolic efficiency and what to make of it, and further what you call the prospect of the disintegration of the basic social bond?
So, yes, the symbolic efficiency, the symbolic efficacy, the status of the symbolic. The one thing you quoted where I said the dead father has died. This is I propose this as sort of formula that encapsulates modernity, the modern shift, because the rule of the dead father, the rule of the name of the father, is something that defined the political power structures from the beginning. Because the Freud's story of the primal court and the killing of the father, and the dead father getting to rule as the law, I mean, the very foundation of the law, this was the beginning of social authority. This was the origin of social authority. And this is why there was the big era where you can sort of concentrate in one word, which is the name of the father, which stands for the efficacy of the symbolic in the, let's say, the pre-modern world. And I think with modernity, this sort of rule was dissolved. The dead father himself has died. The dead father that sustained the sovereignty of kings and the church, or the fathers, and the paternal, all modeled in some way on paternal authority. The rule that was inaugurated thereby is the rule of reason, which should promote science, progress, economic advances, democracy, whatever. So these are the big signifiers, which are actually all premised on a different kind of suppositions. Not anymore the classical authority, the classical paternal authority. We have done away with the classical paternal authority in order to install this modern kind of authority, which would be the pure authority of reason. But it's a shorthand. But what happened was that the dead master came back. The master is undead. It kept coming back in various new forms of mastery. By the way, already Marx had to deal with the figure of Napoleon Bonaparte in the 18th Brumaire, which was maybe the first emergence of this kind of new master, you know, after the death of old masters. But against the precisely as a response to the Democratic Revolution in 1848. And then you had, through the 20th century, the resurgence of the new types of master. And I speak in my text about this anecdote of Freud meeting Dr. Karl Lueger in the Slovene underground. I mean, it's curious that this happened in Slovenia. And you have Freud descending in this cave and then meeting the burgomaster of Vienna, who was actually the origin of anti-Semitic propaganda. The sort of new type of master, the upstart, the populist master. And Lueger was actually, it was the first time that populism as a concept was around. And Lueger was qualified as populist in the 1890s and the beginning of the 20th century. Mm. He was seen as a sort of the coming of a populist master as a sort of return of the repressed, in some sense. The old masters are gone. Now we have a new type of master who is not qualified by neither by the name of the father nor by the authority of reason. There are new types of master which emerge, and all this had consequences through the 20th century and has consequences now with the new rise of populism, enormous consequences, fatal consequences. And one can see the authority of the big other, what was traditionally what Lacan called the big other, is something that is being dismantled progressively. And I was writing about this in the text on the rumors and the rumorization, and the way that the rumors, the spread of rumors, is a sort of profound symptom of this, a profound symptom which accompanied already the rise of the yellow press and then the rise of television, and now has come to a completely new level with internet and the social media. And what is collapsed at the big oppositions on which a certain symbolic instance of the big other nevertheless was maintained throughout. And the first opposition is the one between public and private. The domain of the symbolic big other is the domain of the public. The very public domain is now being collapsed with the private. The line is not drawn any longer. And what collapsed with this is also the line between knowledge and opinion. It seems that the two things start to blend between rumor and information. We are rumorized. The rumor and information nothing carries the stamp of the big other any longer. And furthermore, the divide between the verified and the unverified, and very importantly, the divide between the decent and the indecent. As long as we had some sort of figure of the big other, it's very difficult to say what is decent, because there are no clear laws or rules defining this. But if this collapses, one immediately knows. One immediately sees that there is something profoundly wrong when this difference starts to collapse. So the indecent is being accepted as a sort of rule. And the difference, the divide between producer and consumer, because in classical media, you had a few people who were on television and the masses of us who watched them. And this is what constituted, nevertheless, the space of the big other, the divide between the few and the audience of the many. No? Few people write in newspapers, the masses read them. No? Now, you have the internet, you have the social media, which means we are all producers, we are all consumers, constantly. So the very divide between the two has collapsed. No? And I tried to sum up this development of the collapse of the big other in two simple formulas. And one is that the more there is information around, and there's never been so much information in the whole history of humanity easily available to everyone, the less there is knowledge and the authority of knowledge, which would carry the stamp of the big other. And second, the more there is communication around, and there has never been so much communication ever in the history of humanity. It's so easy to communicate with anyone in the world now. The more a certain fabric of social ties threatens to fall apart. There's a danger of a disintegration of some basic, very basic social bonds. And you can see with the development of populism, which all thrive on this, the cutting of the very suppositions of social bonds, the silent, the unwritten rules, let's say, the unwritten rules on which a social fabric always depends. So this would be two pessimistic formulas. The more there is information, the less there is knowledge. And the more there is the communication, the more we may actually fall apart, form these bubbles and stop just raw violence or antagonism.
Because that's something we appreciate about Robert Fahler, how you have this deferral of belief onto another. What is it, like a place without owners, right? And that's a main feature of something like rumor and gossip and conspiracy. How has Robert Fahler's work influenced yours? Or how do you appreciate his work?
Oh, I highly appreciate his work. I mean, we've been friends for decades. He was here in Ljubljana recently, a month ago. He stays in my apartment. He comes to Ljubljana on a most material, basic level. Yes, of course. I mean, there's some ideas of his, and one idea is the idea of interpassivity, which I find very important. I mean, as a basis of certain social structures, the way that enjoyment can be delegated to machines, the way that enjoyment is not just something you do in something you experience on your own body, as it were, or is your private property, but actually you can delegate it. And it's the way you delegate it to machines, to canned laughter. I mean, this is one of his big examples, but this just stands for so many things. It's basically how you create a certain distribution of social enjoyment, as it were, is something that underpins the social relations. And at the same time, and this goes in a slightly different direction, you have this formula based on Manoni, je sais bien, mais quand même, I know very well, but nevertheless, which Robert expounds in great detail. You have the question of beliefs without owners, which is, again, something that circulates. Everybody disowns this, but nevertheless, everybody participates. Nobody quite believes in rumors, are just a case in point. Nobody quite believes in rumors, but everybody somehow just passes them on, makes them circulate. And once they circulate, I mean, there's a very pernicious side to this. I mean, it's very difficult to disentangle the good and the bad. I mean, there's a necessary function of gossip, which one has to, in a way, espouse. There's no human society without gossip. It's very, very basic social networking. And there is the pernicious side of rumors, the side of rumors which can actually function as something that undermines the authority of the big other and have extremely violent effects. I mean, there's a whole history of rumors which testifies to this, that once you're framed by a rumor, you have no way out. You cannot disentangle yourself from these bad qualifications you were given. No, you can walk away. So both sides are true. And on the gossip side, I would just mention this book by Robin Dunbar, who is an anthropologist, and I find it very amusing, actually far-reaching. And it's called Grooming Gossip and the Origin of Language. And he speaks about the practice of grooming in monkey societies. You know what grooming is, huh? Mm-hmm. And which plays the role of social networking, of establishing hierarchies, who is in, who is out, who grooms whom. No? It's a monkey way of doing this. And at some point he says, well, language is grooming at a distance. It's the same thing, but only not hands-on. it's a reputation match, you know? And reputation management is basically done by gossip. You know? And this is what animals can't do, because you can only gossip about people who are absent. You can't gossip about present, you know. And so the gossip ties are actually necessary ties, but they come with a price, because they form an in-group against the out-group. Yeah? It's us here who get closer ties by gossiping about spreading rumors about the absent, you know, who are the out-group and who may bear the consequences of this animosity towards the absent. You know? So it's a very... Gossip is a very humanizing sort of activity, something that pertains to being human. No? And but you can never, this is the tricky part, you can never disentangle the good part and the bad part. No? The good gossip from bad rumors, as it were. I mean, they're in the sort of Möbius strip. The good parts just turns over into the bad part, the animosity part and the exclusion part. No?
Well, since Slavoj isn't here, but perhaps he's here in spirit, in the Christian sense, the question would be, what points of divergences or differences have emerged within the Troika, you, Slavoj, and Alenka, over time? Is it Zizek's work on quantum physics or his work on Christian atheism, etc.?
Well, yeah. These are two things that... also in the past, when I've been pressed to ask about do we have divergences? I mean, no, we don't have fundamental divergences, but there are the differences of stress, what accent one puts on different things. And neither Alenka nor me have ever written about quantum physics. And Slavoj has devoted a large part of his work where concern he has... He's some sort of obsession or serious enthusiasm for this. He keeps reading these things. I'm kind of skeptical. I mean, I wouldn't dare to write about this, because I don't think I understand. I don't have the competence to judge what is good quantum physics or what is bad quantum physics. I have to believe what the experts tell me, because I have no independent knowledge how to gauge those things. But Slavoj has this, courage, daring, I mean, to engage with these things and draw very speculative consequences from them. I find it extremely interesting, but sort of keep my skepticism. I wouldn't, this is not the kind of thing I would do. But as far as I can see, this is, yes, interesting and valid. I mean, it's a thought experiment, as it were.
Mm.
But I cannot write quite about things when I have to trust the expert knowledge of others. I don't have instruments to measure how these things stand. Then it takes very long education to properly understand the things. And as to the other things, the other thing, it's quite true, as you pointed out, that neither Lenka nor me ever went into this defense of the subversive legacy of Christianity, or that you have to go through Christianity in order to arrive to proper atheism. Again, I read Slava's work on this and find it convincing in many ways, but somehow I'm not so sure that so much can be gained from engaging with Christianity as he hopes he would gain. And he often uses this formula that in Hegelian reading of Christianity, it's the God of beyond that dies on the cross. It's indeed almost verbatim Hegel's words. You know, there was the death of Christ. You no longer have a transcendence on the beyond, and what is left is the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit is precisely the spirit of community. And what Slava tries to do is like communism would be the new name for the Holy Spirit. Now that we should reorganize, there's the death of God in this sense, there's the Holy Spirit, and this should be continued into the communist project, the new way, the logic of communality. I'm more pessimistic about this. I mean, pessimistic, pessimistic in some way, because I think when Nietzsche says God is dead, what he means to say by this is the Holy Spirit is dead. No? It's not that God is dead. It's not just that God is dead, but also this operation that the death of God can be recuperated by Holy Spirit has lost its efficacy. Because the sentence God is dead, God himself has died, is actually the sentence from Hegel's Phenomenology. He says at some point, God himself has died. Das Gott selbst gestorben ist. And he is not proto Nietzsche when he says that, but he quotes Protestant Chora. It's a Protestant song. God himself is dead, but we have the Holy Spirit. So this is Hegel's point in God is dead. We have the Holy Spirit. I think Nietzsche's point is slightly different, that Holy Spirit is also that. And if we want to construct communism, it would have to be on another kind of basis.
Mm. Perhaps this connects with the change in symbolic efficiency.
Absolutely. This is one way to read Nietzsche's formula. God is dead is precisely the death of the dead father. The ending of the symbolic efficacy. Yes. But we never quarreled. I mean, we never seriously quarreled. I mean, there's rather the discussions we have. I don't know if these are the only two people I can have discussions with like that, because is that I think this is the only philosophical dialogue which is interesting. No, because most of the dialogues run out into who will get whom, you know, like who gets the upper hand, who will win the argument. You know? What is usually called philosophical dialogue is, I think, two kinds. One is the dialogue of the deaf, you know, the people don't really listen to each other and they just say, as my esteemed colleague said, I will now, whatever. And the other kind of dialogue is a sort of cutthroat. Like, it can be very polite, but basically it's who will get whom, you know, who will win the argument. But I believe in the third kind of dialogue, which is like friends, sort of like-minded or whatever, try things out, you know, and saying, okay, this I know this is completely crazy, but let me pursue this. For the sake of the whatever speculation, enjoyment, something, let me pursue this, and the other one adds, you know, to this, and it gets completely crazy, you know? By any standards of rational, well argued, based on quotations or whatever, it gets completely out of hand, you know. But I find this kind of thing absolutely productive, you know, that you try things out, and it's only with friends who are like minded you can try. You know, things which may sound absolutely crazy or dangerous or against the common suppositions or whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. way beyond what one would want to say in public and defend serious arguments.
Well, often you can get partway there and you almost need your friend, someone else to finish the idea for you, you know?
Yeah, right. Right, it's beyond like who gets whom, I mean, who will win, and beyond the ownership of ideas, you know, like, this is my idea. I mean, it's just ideas emerge in the air, like when, you know, God knows how they originated. It just belongs to everyone, somehow, they're up there.
Ideas without owners. Well, it's clearly been a very fruitful way of encountering of between you and Zizek of speaking, and with the we don't want to keep you for too long. Maybe we could just ask you about what you're working on now and what you have coming up in the near future.
Yes, there's a booklet which will come out with Polity, which is actually the expansion of the Rumors piece. You know, the piece on Rumors, mm-hmm. in this collective volume. It was limited, well, obviously it had to be limited to 10,000 words. It's like 10,003 words, I think.
3 words for free.
And the Polity then, on the basis of this piece, offered to make a small publication, which is like 25,000 words. I mean, it's still a small book, but yes, this is done. It's in the process. Yeah. And then there's another book coming up with Verso. Which is like a collection of 10 basic pieces I've done over the years on the very basis of psychoanalysis. Well, why I think this is important, what is the why dreams, why the drive, what is transference? I mean, there are some very, very basic entry points. And well, the amusing part is that I had a conversation with Sebastian Bazin, the editor, and somewhere in the conversation, this the crisis of psychoanalysis came up, and how, I mean, the way we compare what happened like 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, to the status of psychoanalysis today, which is, I think, it's profoundly marginalized in the public space now. It's a serious crisis. And somehow this phrase came up that we should speak not about what is psychoanalysis, but what was psychoanalysis. Hmm. And Sebastian got very enthusiastic about it. But why don't you give it this title? What was psychoanalysis?
Provocative. maybe I can use your book for when I'm arguing with my friends about psychoanalysis. It sometimes happens.
We just had a conversation last weekend where a group of our friends refused to believe that dreams could mean anything, yeah, right. Not even formally. And it was a total non-starter.
Right. No, I think psychoanalysis is in big trouble, in serious big trouble. But it's not just psychoanalysis. I mean, one could entitle the book, what was Marxism? What was critical thought? I don't know, what was feminism? It's the critical theory and psychoanalysis was part of this, and a particularly acute, extreme part of this, a I think this has to do with the authority of the Big Other, which has failed, and the symbolic impact that thought can have. And I don't know. I was maybe we should finish. I was there in January 1980 when the counties banned the school, when there was the distribution. It was the front page news. I mean, it was absolutely primetime news. The counties banned the school, and not only in Paris but worldwide. I mean, somehow the very school that was the result of his efforts for 20 years, for so many years, and would seem to embody the Big Other thing. At the height of the what seemed great success, he disbanded. So it was primetime news and it was global news. If any psychoanalyst does, anything today, it will hardly find a place on the page 36. So I'm just speaking about the magnitude, the order of magnitude. I mean, that one symbolic gesture could have absolutely global public effect. Mm-hmm. But now it's very difficult to do this, and particularly in psychoanalysis, which has been so compartmentalized, whatever. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The tongue twister.
Sorry, I don't want to keep you. Maybe I shouldn't ask this question, but I heard you referenced a correlation in the fall of the kind of primacy of psychoanalysis with the rise of different cures, pharmaceutical cures, or different therapeutic models.
Yes. I think the external reasons for this downfall or this loss of symbolic impact has to do, I mean, in the immediate sense, with the rise of pharmaceuticals, the pharmaceutical industry. The first way one deals today with any psychic trouble is to have great pills. And there's a sort of the zero supposition of, I hardly know everyone in the Western world who wouldn't be eating some sort of pills or another, you know, either to calm you down or for sleep or to wake you up or whatever, for excitation. I mean, both the calmness and the excitants. I mean, there's some sort of calibration. Or antidepressants or anything. The sort of zero subject is heavily medicalized. I mean, it's psychopharmaca. And there is the large market of therapies. There's been a therapeutization of society. I mean, quite Foucauldian sort of thing, incredible spread. And there's also the third factor, which is a sort of sectarianism of psychoanalytic groups. Now, we spend a lot of time fighting each other, but fighting between themselves without quite noticing how marginalized they have become. Who is the true Lacanian? Who is the true bearer? Or whatever. But all this, okay, these are factors, but I mean, all this is against a large background of the rise of neoliberalism and its sort of excrescences now in the rise of new populism. I think the whole, I mean, it's a defeat. It's the defeat of critical thought. It's the defeat of the left. We were not capable to propose a good project, stick by it, and make it happen. It's our own weakness as well. It's not enough to just blame the wicked other.
Well, I think with a mind to the time, we should probably leave it there. But Laurent Doller, thank you very much for joining with us. We're very happy to speak with you. And thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. And well, I hope you edit this because I have the impression that it went in all directions. I don't know.
We'll take care of that. Yeah. Thank you. Very much appreciate you speaking with us today. Yeah. Thanks so much, Martin.
Okay.
Goodbye.
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 It's the one. 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 It's the one
Thank you.